Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Thank you, Estelle. Coming up on today's show, a court in Egypt has approved the freezing of assets of five prominent human rights activists and three NGOs. This is the latest development in a case that has been ongoing for around 5 years. But what does this say about the continued crackdown on activists and journalists in Egypt?
The International Court of Justice in The Hague will begin hearing testimony this week in the case of disputed ocean boundaries between the East African nations of Somalia and Kenya.
After over 50 years of a diplomatic freeze, US-Cuban relations saw a huge leap forward earlier this year as US President Barack Obama visited Havana and brought about a normalising of relations between the two countries. But Republican hopeful Donald Trump could be about to undo all that work. We look at comments he made over the weekend and the way forward for US-Cuba relations.
With every EU summit comes talk of an EU army, a force to match that of NATO, to ensure the collective defence of the EU member states. But just how likely is an EU army?
And in which country do one in five people think the Earth doesn't orbit the sun and half the population believe in evolution?
All that and more over the next half hour on this Monday edition of World in Focus.
Courts in Egypt this week approved an asset freeze of five prominent human rights activists and three non-governmental organisations. This is the latest development in a case that has been ongoing for around 5 years. This week's announcement leaves the activists and NGOs penniless with no update on when their case will be heard.
Egypt's crackdown on human rights activists and political protests has been widely condemned by human rights groups such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. A Human Rights Watch report on the situation says, quote, authorities have effectively banned protests, imprisoned tens of thousands, often after unfair trials, and outlawed the country's largest opposition group, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Joining me on the line from Amnesty International is their Egypt researcher, Nicolas Piachot. Thank you for joining us, Nicolas. In this latest twist in a five-year case, along with many reports of media censorship, of forced disappearances of protesters and activists, does this bring us to a situation in which anyone critical of President Sisi is treated as a threat to national security?
Absolutely. I mean, these are the groups and these are the people who have spent their lives documenting these kinds of human rights violations. They're the ones who have exposed the hundreds of enforced disappearances that we've seen in Egypt over the last year or so. They're the people who have been standing up for victims of torture and who have been defending political prisoners in court. It's no wonder that Egypt's authorities want to shut them down. These people, these award-winning activists, have dedicated their lives to defending the rights of others. And on Saturday, a court took everything from them just for doing so.
Now, I believe that since Sisi came into power as well, they've even adapted the definition of terrorism, creating a rather more vague term. Is this another way to pass down harsher sentences to these activists?
Well, we've seen some human rights defenders already facing charges under the counterterrorism law. I mean, that law's definition of terrorism is so broad as to be essentially meaningless. It includes offences like harming money, for example, which could mean, I don't know, losing change down the back of the sofa. The point is, it means anything that the authorities want it to mean. You can be a terrorist if you're a journalist. You can be a terrorist if you're a human rights defender. And that's part of the problem in Egypt today, that the authorities seem fundamentally unable or unwilling to make the difference between a journalist or a political activist and a member of an armed group, a genuine threat to Egypt's security. Egypt is spending a lot of its time locking up journalists and human rights defenders when it should be going after the really substantial threats to its security.
And given the level of disappearances that Amnesty International have highlighted, the crackdown on journalists, I believe one journalist was even handed a death sentence last year. And since 2013, there have been hundreds of death sentences handed out on dubious court trials. Now, why is there not much more of an outcry in the international community about this? Are people just unaware of this situation?
I think people are aware. I mean, I think generally people seem to be aware of what's happening, but I think there's a sense of increasing resignation. And I think what's lacking is a sense of outrage. And that's deeply troubling because we have seen a human rights situation which has spiraled into crisis. In August 2013, security forces walked into a sit-in in Cairo and killed upwards of 700 people in a single day. anywhere else, that would have provoked widespread outrage, that would have made Egypt into an international pariah. But today, world leaders and would-be world leaders like Hillary Clinton are sitting down with the Egyptian authorities and trying to do business. And I think that's part of the fundamental problem we have with Egypt, which is that people want to be seen to be criticizing human rights violations, but states care more about selling arms and equipment and signing lucrative trade deals than they do rule of law or human rights.
And just finally, with this recent crackdown, now with these human rights activists who are facing trial and could be handed life sentences, is it getting to the state where it is now just too unsafe for NGOs and activists to even operate in Egypt?
Well, I think increasingly so, yes. And I think many of the people who have been left penniless by this weekend's court ruling will find it very difficult to operate. I mean, beyond, these rather faceless NGOs, are these extraordinary women and men who have spent their lives defending the rights of others, and now they will be struggling to survive. And I think that's the chilling signal that Egyptian civil society will get from this weekend's court message, which is that if you stand up to the Egyptian authorities, if you expose abuses, then you could be left with nothing.
Well, Nicholas Piacho, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Still to come on the programme, the International Court of Justice in The Hague will begin hearing testimony this week in the case of disputed ocean boundaries between the East African nations of Somalia and Kenya.
After over 50 years of a diplomatic freeze, US-Cuban relations saw huge leaps forward earlier this year as US President Barack Obama visited Havana and brought about a normalising of relations between the two countries. But Republican hopeful Donald Trump could be about to undo all that work. We look at his comments made over the weekend and the way forward for US-Cuba relations.
With every EU summit comes talk of an EU army, a force to match that of NATO to ensure the collective defence of the EU member states. But just how likely is an EU army?
And in which country do one in five people think that the Earth doesn't orbit the sun, and half, yes, half the population believe in evolution?
Not Scott.
The International Court of Justice, or ICJ, will this week begin court proceedings to settle a maritime boundary dispute between the East African nations of Kenya and Somalia. The Kenyan Attorney General will lead the Kenyan delegation in The Hague, presenting its submissions to the court in response to a suit which was filed by the Federal Republic of Somalia in 2014.
Somalian officials requested that the court determine the precise geographical boundary between Kenya and Somalia in the Indian Ocean, a dispute which has been ongoing for years, but has come to prominence since the election of the Somalian president in 2012, following years of conflict. Currently, around 60,000 square miles of sea sit within the disputed territory. Previous attempts to create a fair border between the two nations have failed to come to any compromise.
The situation has become of even greater importance since the discovery of vast oil reserves off the African coast. Joining me on the line now is Professor Ken Menkhouse from the Davidson University, North Carolina, Professor of Politics and Political Advisor on Relations in the Horn of Africa. Professor Menkhouse, is this confirmation of sovereignty even more important for Somalia, given the current political climate? The country was, of course, internationally considered to be a failed state until 2012.
That's part of it. The fact that there is now a sovereign government for the first time in over 20 years means that there is an authority that can begin to address some of the border issues. But in this particular case, maritime borders along East Africa were largely ignored by governments across the board. They simply weren't important. Now they are, thanks to the discovery of significant gas and oil deposits offshore. So now they have lots of value, and that's what this is ultimately about.
And if the court case were to rule that the border be moved in Somalia's favour, could, in with that regard, that there is a lot of oil there, could Kenya then raise a complaint around their southern border? And could this perhaps have a domino effect all the way along the eastern coast of Africa, down through Madagascar, for example?
Yes, you're exactly right. This is a case that has much wider implications. The Somali claim is that they want the border, the maritime border, to run in a northeast to southwest pattern following the land border between Somalia and Kenya. Kenya has another border with Tanzania that also on land runs northeast to southwest. But again, with Tanzania, the maritime border has been strictly an east-west latitude border, so that if suddenly Somalia's border now cuts across Kenya, coastal Kenya, and Kenya does not have a change in the Tanzania border, it's almost cut off from access to open waters by the combination of Tanzania and Somalia. So they will certainly contest the Tanzania border then, and that, as you said, will trickle all the way down into southern Africa.
What do you think the potential outcome of the court case could be? I believe that in the past they have tried a UN intervention to find a compromise between the two current borders, the one that Kenya recognises and the one that Somalia recognises. Though Kenya weren't happy with that decision, they weren't willing to compromise, I believe. So are they likely to even acknowledge the result of the court case? And if it does indeed go against them, could they appeal this or could they just outright ignore this?
I'm not an international lawyer, so I don't know what kind of appeal process there may be. I will tell you that whichever country is on the losing side of the ruling will reject it. There's way too much at stake for both Somalia and Kenya. But I'll also tell you that the long-term impact, or at least the medium-term impact, is likely to be negligible. And that is because the price of oil has dropped significantly, and the cost of drilling in those waters is very high. It made more sense when the price of oil was very high. But for now, I don't foresee anyone drilling in and exploiting the oil anytime soon, particularly if the territory remains contested. No company is going to sink very expensive costs into offshore oil rigs in a context of that kind of uncertainty.
Well, Professor Menkos, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Said consistently, after more than five very difficult decades, the relationship between our governments will not be transformed overnight. We continue, as President Castro indicated, to have some very serious differences, including on democracy and human rights. Perhaps most importantly, I affirm that Cuba's destiny will not be decided by the United States or any other nation. Cuba is sovereign and rightly has great pride, and the future of Cuba will be decided by Cubans, not by anybody else.
U.S. President Barack Obama speaking earlier this year in Havana following the historic normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba. The two countries had, of course, severed all diplomatic ties for decades following the Cuban Revolution, in which the U.S.-backed military dictator Batista was toppled by revolutionary forces led by Fidel Castro.
Subsequent alliances with the Soviet Union and its role at the center of the Cold War through the Cuban Missile Crisis meant that relations between Washington and Havana have remained frosty ever since. Indeed, a full trade embargo has been adhered to by the U.S. ever since October 1960. So the international reaction to this year's visit by Barack Obama was naturally viewed as a major step forward in finally laying to rest the remnants of the Cold War.
That could be about to be undone, though, following comments by the Republican candidate for the US presidency, Donald Trump, made over the weekend.
The president's one-sided deal for Cuba and with Cuba benefits only the Castro regime. But all of the concessions that Barack Obama has granted the Castro regime were done through executive order, which means the next president can reverse them. And that I will do unless the Castro regime meets our demands. Not my demands, our demands. You know what the demands are. Those demands will include religious and political freedom for the Cuban people and the freeing of political prisoners. The freeing of political prisoners.
U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump speaking at the weekend about the recent developments in U.S.-Cuban relations, threatening to undo them if Cuba did not adhere to demands over human rights and political prisoners.
Cuba, of course, continues to argue that the U.S. has responsibilities regarding human rights violations themselves at Guantanamo Bay. Mr. Trump neglected to address that point, however. Now, we thought we'd also take a look at what Mr. Trump's main opponent, Hillary Clinton, had to say on the subject of Cuba. Here she is speaking earlier this year.
The Cuban people deserve to have their human rights respected and upheld. They deserve to be able to move toward democracy where they pick their own leaders. And I think both Castros have to be considered authoritarian and dictatorial because they are not freely chosen by the people that are in Cuba. I hope someday there will be leaders who are chosen by the Cuban people. And I hope that democracy will be deeply rooted in Cuban soil and that the people of Cuba will have every opportunity to fulfill their own dreams in their own country. That is my hope.
Democratic candidate for the US presidency Hillary Clinton referring to the situation in Cuba as undemocratic. Raul Castro is, of course, the brother of Fidel Castro, whom he inherited the office of Cuban president from in 2008. We spoke with Luis Perez at the University of North Carolina earlier today, and he told us that he believed US policy towards Cuba has never changed.
There's a kind of an illusion out in the world at large that US policy has changed, and US policy remains, for all intents and purposes, unchanged. What has changed is the means. For 50 years, the United States has said they will not negotiate with Cuba until Cuba changes a whole series of policies. And what the Obama administration has done is to turn that policy on its head and saying we will normalize relations as a way to obtain those changes. So anyone who examines the public statements of representatives of the administration, congressional hearings, policy statements, the crux of American policy continues unchanged. The only difference is that rather than pursuing change of regime, what they're trying to do is change within the regime.
Luis Perez from the University of North Carolina there, and apologies, that perhaps wasn't the clearest line in the world. Joining me on the line now from Pittsburgh, though, is Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies at Carnegie Mellon University, Kenya Dworkin. Thanks for speaking with us, Professor Dworkin. Given how long it's taken for the US and Cuba to reach the place they're at now, how helpful would you say Donald Trump's comments are?
Well, I don't think they're helpful at all, but it may depend on what constituency you're talking about. I mean, it may be that those who are opposed to Obama's new relationship with Cuba and the efforts that he has made to normalize relations would be very happy to have Donald Trump reverse any progress, and I say that in quotes, that has been made. So, again, I think it depends. I think overall it's certainly a step in the wrong direction, because even though I feel that this normalization had to occur, and I do feel that there are a lot of issues regarding the effects of this normalization on ordinary people in Cuba are an unknown for, at least I can speak for people in the United States. Hmm. And so therefore I would say there are some limitations to the impact that this new relationship is going to have. I don't think it would be in any way, shape, or form wise to reverse the direction that things are going in.
The underlying mood music, though, if you like, coming from the US, and that applies to not just to Donald Trump, but to Hillary Clinton and indeed to Barack Obama as well, is heavily focused on human rights in Cuba and a need for a change in human rights in Cuba. Just how compatible is that kind of demand where none of those candidates or the current president seem willing to address the obvious elephant in the room, which is Guantanamo Bay?
That's true, and I think that would be fair to characterize the majority of what has happened so far in the normalization as a reestablishment of diplomatic relations and an easing of the possibility of doing business between the two countries. I don't think that a lot of attention has been paid to the issue of human rights, although it is an enormous problem in Cuba, but I don't think that the United States is in a position to say, we'll normalize relations with you, but you have to do this, that, and the other. So well, I think that they realize that they could not, append that as a requirement for normalizing relations.
Is that almost just an impossible task, really, for the USA to try and undertake? Because, I mean, after all, how receptive are Cubans ever going to be to phrases, to quote Donald Trump, where he said that Cuba must meet our demands?
They're not going to, and neither the government nor the Cuban people are going to respond to something like that. But the Cuban people in large number are very, very anxious for change in their daily lives. And that's the part that people here don't know about. People here tend to see this as an opportunity for Americans to travel to Cuba more easily, but they believe in trickle-down economics. Maybe they think that this is going to alleviate the economic situation of everyday people, but it isn't, and it's not going to.
We don't hear a great deal about the vision for the future that the Cuban people have. As you say, there's a thirst for change there. I mean, what exactly would that change look like? I'm assuming it's not identical to the U.S.
vision. One of the things that people... Oh, not at all. And that would never be good for Cuba. There are many, many activist groups in Cuba that are much more visible than they used to be. Of course, the press only pays attention to people like the ladies in white. They have drawn a lot of attention to problems, but they're not working on the ground. I actually personally am involved with people who work on the ground to try to bring around political and social change by modifying their constitution, by gaining more citizen access to actual participation in government. And there's a lot going on in Cuba that nobody ever talks about, and that gets out because certain people are connected with people down there who are actively involved and have been since 2007, 2008. And these are not people who are being funded, you know, by the extreme right wing here in the U.S., which is shrinking. In the Cuban exile community, that's a very multifaceted community now with generational differences, political differences, and this is something that's never talked about. But there are many things going on in Cuba. There are many people working in Cuba towards progress, in other words, a revolution that will evolve into something that may look in the future like a social democracy.
Kenya Dworkin, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The notion of an EU army has been a source of great speculation for some time now. This weekend, it was the United Kingdom's Defence Secretary Michael Fallon who caught the media's attention by stating that the United Kingdom will veto any attempts to create an EU army, despite Britain voting to leave the EU in June.
The proposals that are going to be put forward this December, however, are not so much about creating an EU army. Rather, they're about altering the current workings of the European Union Military Committee, the EUMC. This week, both France and Germany are putting forward their arguments as to why their nations should host the European headquarters of the EUMC.
Joining me on the line is Andrea Frontini, policy analyst at the European Policy Centre. Andrea, the current proposals that are going to be put forward by the European Commission in December, they're not really proposals for an EU army, are they? They're more about the creation of a more permanent headquarters for the EUMC, are they not?
Yeah, the European Commission itself will not be pushing for any concrete proposal even on the military headquarters or the CSDP civilian and military headquarters. The European Commission will be working on something else, which is the European Defence Package or Action Plan, and it's going to be mostly about the economic and industrial components of European defence. Those in charge of putting forth proposals for the headquarters will rather be those of the European External Action Service, so it is mostly a decision with Ms. Mogherini. But this is something that also needs to be discussed with member states. So there's no kind of supranational push beyond that. It is a proposal that has been tabled by two capitals in particular. It has been gaining already some consensus among other capitals, including those of some bigger member states like Italy, and I think also Poland is not necessarily against this idea. But of course, it's something that needs to be discussed in the council among defense and foreign ministers. So we will see more clearly in the next weeks if this idea will actually fly.
And just finally then, how far off do you think the European Union is from creating the EU army that the media speaks of, the EU army that the people understand as being a completely joined force of EU member states? How far away do you think that is?
I think we're still pretty far from that. The idea of a unified armed force, uniting all Europeans under joint command, is more of a, let's say, political project which in some capitals is still somehow caressed. That's the case, for instance, of Germany, Italy, and very few others. Whereas it is mostly opposed by other countries which are more attached to their own sovereignty. But in a way, it is this kind of debate of the EU army is again quite misleading. It's a forced problem. I believe what is needed nowadays, and that's what really is on the table, is a kind of pragmatic way forward to creating a more coordinating and more joint actions in the defense and security areas. The idea of reactivating the battle groups, for instance, could be one the permanent structured cooperation. This idea also circulated by Italy of creating a sort of European defense union, which would basically be a kind of permanent structured cooperation, but plus in the sense that it would be in a way more ambitious and it could be extended then to the other member states in a future revision of treaties. The debate is very much about a progressive way of ensuring more coordination and more cooperation, not only for the political aim of having more solidarity in these matters, but also out of efficiency considerations on the economic gains that would come from greater efficiency on, let's say, capacity development on the defense industry, procurement, and other policy areas. So, again, the EU army idea was evoked by President Juncker, mostly, I think, with a kind of provocative objective. It stayed in the debate, but now it is somehow distorting the very rationale of all this discussion. So I'm always a bit skeptical about using the idea of EU army to be in favour or against further integration in defence and security in the EU.
Well, Andrea Frontini, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
A major new study run by researchers at the University of Aberdeen has used an analysis of rocks in Scotland's Outer Hebridean Islands to conclude that there could possibly be life on Mars.
The work analysed the way that rocks in the islands of Barra and Uist undergo tremors, which then generate hydrogen within the Earth's crust. Scientists suggest that rocks on Mars undergo similar tremors known as Mars quakes, which could be producing life-sustaining conditions on the red planet.
Joining us on the line from the University of Aberdeen is the lead researcher, Professor John Parnell. Thank you for joining us, John. So do you think then that there is currently life on Mars?
What we're saying is that there is a habitat on Mars, which is created by fault activity and the resultant earthquakes, which, if there was life on the Martian surface, would be able to take advantage of that.
Would this be life that's more than just microbes? Does that environment that you think could exist there, would it support what even a layperson would perhaps identify as a life form, a creature of some form?
No, where we have life using hydrogen on Earth, it's extremely simple life, mostly single-celled, and it's not even at the surface. It's beneath the surface in pore spaces and fracture systems. So we are talking about a deep biosphere on Earth, and by extension, it would be a deep biosphere on Mars.
And this environment that you're now identifying on Mars, would this make it easier for the Martian surface and atmosphere to be manipulated or adapted to allow humans to live there in a self-sustaining manner at all?
No, this has got nothing to do with human occupation of Mars.
So we're not looking at a kind of discovery that could make it easier for people to inhabit the landscape?
Not at all, no. What we're doing is identifying a habitat which has potential on Mars and indeed on any rocky planet to support any life that might arise there. But it would be simple life.
I imagine scientifically that if we were to be able to go to Mars and find this simple life existing there, that we could learn quite a lot from it and how it's adapted.
I think if we found life on Mars, then just about anything is possible.
And are you hopeful that perhaps they might soon be able to find life on Mars?
I think it would be an extremely interesting occurrence. It would certainly shake up mankind, but I think it's unlikely to happen in my lifetime.
Well, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Not at all. Bye-bye.
Yes, but Carolyn, is there life on Mars?
Well, that's what I was trying to get him to say, but
I noticed that.
Yeah, well,
it was a valiant effort.
Well, anyway,
I don't think there is, though, Carolyn.
Finally, a new survey by the National Science Foundation, or NSF, of 2,000 Americans designed to measure education standards in the US has revealed some slightly unnerving statistics. Generally speaking, the most basic science-based question is, does the Earth orbit the Sun? So does the Earth orbit the Sun, Jack?
Yes, Carolyn, the Earth orbits the Sun.
Yes, it does. Apparently, though, 1 in 5 Americans don't think it does.
Hey. What do they think does happen?
I'm not entirely sure. I can only assume that they probably think that the Sun goes around the Earth.
That doesn't sound too crazy. I mean, if you've never looked into it, if you don't know anything about it.
I'm going to pretend I didn't hear you say that, Jack, and move swiftly on to what is maybe an even more worrying statistic, that 48% of people agreed that human beings had evolved from the earlier species of animals.
48%, that's less than half.
Yep, less than half of Americans think that evolution is a thing. And 42% thought astrology was a science.
Which it's not. I'm lost for words, Carolyn. But that is unfortunately all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. It's probably appropriate that I'm lost for words. Don't forget you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik from Edinburgh, and you've got to DC for Tom Hartman's show in just a moment. Till tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott.
And me, Jack Foster.
Goodbye.